to memorialize our victory in Europe over Germany, and will rededicate the mighty energies of America to the speedy prosecution of the war against Japan. On this memorable broadcast, you will hear from Fleet Admiral William D. Lay, Chief of Staff to the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy. From General of the Army, George C. Marshall, Chief of Staff, United States Army. From the Commander-in-Chief, United States Fleet, Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King. From the Supreme Commander, Allied Expeditionary Forces, General of the Army, Dwight D. Eisenhower. And from Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief, United States Pacific Fleet and Pacific Ocean Areas. From the General of the Army, H.H. Arnold, Commanding General Army Air Forces. And from the General of the Army, Douglas A. MacArthur, Commanding General, United States Army Forces in the Pacific. This broadcast will be shortwave to our troops and allies throughout the world. We take you now to Washington.
In our nation's capital today, an atmosphere of calm thanksgiving permeates the city. After President Truman's victory announcement at 9 a.m., work as usual continued at the White House and in the government buildings. We still have a job to do. Tonight, the great dome of the Capitol will be ablaze with light for the first time since Pearl Harbor. Hundreds have made quiet pilgrimages to the Lincoln Memorial. And across the Potomac, the unknown soldier of the last war sleeps quietly in Arlington Cemetery. The nation is grateful. And the chief army chaplains, Brigadier General Luther D. Miller, leads us in a solemn prayer of thanksgiving for the victory of our arms in Europe.
God of battles, we thank thee for the victory won by our fellow workers, our fellow soldiers, and our allies, and the capitulation of the vanquished enemy of mankind. We thank thee for our leaders, whose vision charted our course, and whose wisdom guided us successfully to the objectives now attained. For our fellow workers, whose industry has produced in incredible measure the sinews of war, and whose zeal provided the support needed by our fighters, we thank thee, O Lord. For the members of our armed forces, whose sacrifices brought the security of our nation, and whose valor has been its glory and salvation, we thank thee, O Lord. For our allies who have shared our labors and dangers, and who now rejoice with us, we thank thee, O Lord. God of peace, we thank thee for the liberation of the captives and the oppressed, both of our own and other nations. We thank thee for the promise of the final success of our efforts in this world conflict and the resultant opportunity to reestablish peace and the furtherance of thy will among all men in all the nations of the earth. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
To the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, both with the late President Roosevelt and now with President Truman, Fleet Admiral William D. Leahy has seen the war in Europe through from beginning to end. He speaks to us now from Washington, Admiral Leahy.
We cannot help being overawed by the great event in which we share today. We have seen now all but the final act of the stupendous drama of the past decade. That decade witnessed an attempt by the remorseless forces of barbarism to overrun and enslave the peace-loving peoples of the earth. The attempt almost succeeded, but finally it has failed. We record today the unconditional surrender of the barbarians of the West. Our ability to comprehend this in its true proportions is small. We can feel, but we cannot yet understand. The perspective of time is needed to evaluate it in its full grandeur. Roughly, we know what has happened. The giant of German militarism, arrayed in its power and contemptuous of the values of civilization and democracy, lies destroyed before us. We and our allies have destroyed it. Millions of our men and women, although hating war, found the strength and skill to wage war more successfully than those brutal belligerents who worshipped the war. In the vast Atlantic theater, we are now unconditionally victorious. And we move on, with a front of still strong but already doomed enemy in the Pacific. In this historic struggle, in which every nation on the earth was involved in some degree, the United States has played a major role. Each allied nation has lent itself, without stint or measure, to the common struggle and the final victory. Never in the world's military history has there been such a successful demonstration of coalition war. The list of heroic achievements of our allies is long. For our part, we may recognize the eminent achievements of our own arms and of our own nation. Our armies, our naval fleets, and air forces have dealt crushing and fatal blows to the enemy in Europe, while at the same time hammering their way across the Pacific to the gates of Japan. While we mobilized, we sustained our allies with food and the materials of war, and continued to supply them, even while our vast forces struck and struck again at the enemy. But it is certain that the one circumstance without which victory would have been impossible was the combined strength of the Allied coalition. In that Allied unity, we take our greatest pride. Without that unity, without the coalition of all our forces, our nation today would stand in dreadful peril. Today it is fitting that we pay reverent tribute to Master Architect of that unity, as he was also the Master Architect of our own military accomplishments, our late beloved Commander-in-Chief, Franklin Roosevelt. That great spirit understood the world's peril long before it took the open form of war. He prepared his nation for it within the limits of feasibility and early threw our moral and material weight into the scales. At that moment, the forces of aggression were doomed, even while they were winning victories. When the Axis powers, in their anguish for conquest, threw caution to the winds and launched what they thought would be the final assault, our brave commander-in-chief addressed words of courage to the Congress, words which emboldened and refreshed all the world's forces of resistance. He said, "With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounded determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God." That brave pledge is now fulfilled in part. With victory over Japan, it will be wholly accomplished. I may say today that President Roosevelt's wisdom and amazing grasp of world geography and military capacities played an all-important part in leading the forces of the coalition and our own to victory. We, who were privileged to serve under him in high staff and command posts, today salute this brave soldier who fell in battle, in the same sense that we salute those millions of others of our own and of other lands who died that this nation and its neighbors across the seas might fulfill their destinies in peace, freedom, and friendship. The millions of men in the ranks who fought this war have earned our undying gratitude. Their deeds speak for themselves much better than I can speak for them. We are proud as well as grateful for their sacrifices, their endurance under unspeakable conditions, their courage and their valorous maintenance of all the highest traditions of this nation. And for those who died, there are no words at all. We grieve for them, and in our sorrow, we are more firmly resolved to achieve in full the purposes for which they died. Victory in this war was won not by navies and armies alone. The war has been waged and won by entire peoples. We must acknowledge in our own land the contribution of those millions at home who converted our factories, farms, and workshops into an arsenal of unprecedented productivity. From that arsenal, we supplied our own forces and those of our allies. Labor and management share fully in today's victory. For the military waging of this war, it became necessary to provide an effective coordination of the various arms and branches of the service. For amphibious warfare and for coordinated air, sea, and land attacks on many far-flung fronts, it was imperative to bring about an intimate association of the forces of the Army, of the Navy, and of the air. This was achieved not without difficulty, but it was achieved. Today, on the fighting fronts, there is no distinction, except in function, among the personnel of the different services. Operational command has been unified. There has been a complete alliance of our own arms, and for this, high credit is due to my three colleagues of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Marshall, Admiral King, and General Arnold. Now, with the hosts of evil and barbarism vanquished in Europe, we must turn our full attention to the Far East. There, we still have a powerful enemy who boasts that he is willing and ready to fight on for 100 years if necessary. We assure him that it will not take that long. Still, he has powerful legions of troops in his home islands and on the coast of China, perhaps 7 million of them. Although the vast circumference of his empire has been shrunk by our assaults, his naval power destroyed, and his air forces crippled, we have a long road to travel before victory. Japan must be beaten into defeat, into unconditional surrender. The reconquest of the Philippines was a step in that direction. The remaining steps must and will be taken. We have no intention of relaxing until the Eastern barbarian shares the fate of his partner. We have not forgotten Pearl Harbor. We know that the American people, with equal devotion and sacrifice, will support their sons and brothers who will be fighting our savage enemies in the far Pacific until the final victory is won.
Thank you. hear from the man who trained and developed the American Army and deployed it to theaters of war in the farthest reaches of the world. The Combined American Networks bring you General of the Army, George C. Marshall, Chief of Staff, United States Army. General Marshall.
Today we celebrate a great victory, a day of solemn thanksgiving. My admiration and gratitude go first to those who have fallen, and to the men of the American armies of the air and ground, whose complete devotion to duty and indomitable courage have overcome the enemy and every conceivable obstacle in achieving this historic victory. To their commanders, who organized and led the invasions of Europe across the seas, in the air and on the ground, through Africa and Italy and France, into the heart of Germany, I pay tribute. They have been superb. Superb in their courage and in the efficiency of their leadership. History and the returning veterans will give them far more of praise than we will accord them in the celebrations of the day. For the Allied fighting men, for their officers and great leaders who fought with us, who cooperated so wholeheartedly, so generously with us, especially in the critical moments of the war, I express profound admiration and deepest appreciation. They have proved conclusively with us that democracies can successfully cooperate in unity for a great and common purpose. We owe our thanks and acknowledgement to the naval forces and seamen who gave faultless support to the landings on hostile shores and who guarded the millions of men and their supplies across the Atlantic and into the Mediterranean. The success of every campaign and operation has depended upon those who labored day and night to supply our armies, to establish their communications, to perform miracles of engineering in advancing the fighting men. The record of the tasks in organization, supply, and equipment, in tactical and strategical triumphs, compose too vast a pattern of remarkable achievements to summarize today or in any one day. The world has never dreamed of such undertakings, just as the world has never witnessed such a victory. The enemy and the pessimist together have been swept from the board by a long succession of victories, culminating today in the final triumph, the complete destruction of German military power. Let us celebrate the victory and say our prayers of thanksgiving, and then turn with all the power and stern resolution of America to destroy forever and in the shortest possible time every vestige of military power in the Japanese nation.
That was General of the Army George C. Marshall, Chief of Staff, United States Army, speaking to the nation and to the American troops under his command round the world. Standing by at his headquarters in Europe is the Supreme Commander, Allied Expeditionary Forces, General of the Army Dwight D. Eisenhower, victorious leader of the mightiest invasion force in history, conqueror of the German Army on the Western Front. We take you now to Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Forces, and General Eisenhower.
I have the rare privilege of speaking for a victorious army of almost 5 million fighting men. They and the women who have so ably assisted them constitute the Allied Expeditionary Force that has liberated Western Europe. They have destroyed or captured enemy armies totaling more than their own strength and swept triumphantly forward over the hundreds of miles separating Cherbourg from Lübeck, Leipzig, and Munich. More than 3 years ago, Great Britain, China, and Russia were desperately defending themselves against the onslaughts of mighty military machines, deliberately prepared to implement the Axis purpose to dominate the world. The dastardly crime of Pearl Harbor brought us suddenly and actively into that war. Our nation, always unwilling to attribute evil purposes to any people, and unready to withstand surprise attack, found itself beaten back from some of its important outposts, and unable to take prompt and effective action to combat the enemy's designs. But America, fortunate in the quality of her leadership, did not become the easy prey envisaged by her self-confident assailants. Our late great president immediately met with that other indomitable spirit, Prime Minister Churchill, the man who has successfully led his country through the dark days of 40 and 41, when Great Britain stood alone as the unconquered foe of Nazism. Even while Allied defenses in the far Pacific were still crumbling under the swift attacks of the Japanese, these great leaders and their able lieutenants began devising the gigantic plan of which the first two difficult parts have now reached glorious consummation. In the very beginning, the United States and Great Britain determined to combine themselves into a true partnership for the prosecution of the war. They adopted as their first objective the crushing of the European Axis. This task they undertook first because only here was it possible for three great powers, Russia, Great Britain, and the United States, to concentrate their full might against one part of the widely separated Axis powers. Realizing that battlefield efficiency demanded unification in action as well as in purpose, America and Great Britain decided to place their combined forces in every theater under single command. Out of adherence to this principle has flowed success. Air, ground, navy, supply, all have been combined into one great team without regard to national or personal considerations. Into this team have been drawn representatives of many other nations. All have absorbed the same spirit of loyalty and teamplay. And their success in working effectively together under conditions of stress and strain, of difficulty and success, is something of which every participating country can always be proud. Here, the United Nations have proved the possibilities of real cooperation. And let me remind you, at home, of your place in this team. Without your unremitting labor, your financial and moral support, without your determination, nothing could have been accomplished. We here clearly recognize this and are proud to feel that you and ourselves are one. With the progress of the war in this theater, every family, every individual is familiar. The dramatic accomplishments of G.I. Joe and his comrades of every nation, fighting in the air, on the land, and on the sea, have been recorded for you daily by press and radio. Starting first with a diversionary but most important attack in North Africa, a bitter campaign ensued in which the United Nations regained the use of the Mediterranean as a valuable channel of communications. The enemy forces in Africa were utterly destroyed, and Italy, as a Thatcher's power, was knocked out of the war. With these purposes achieved, the United Nations, with the huge quantities of supplies, special equipment, and forces they had in the meantime developed, were ready to initiate the principal feature of their European strategy, the assault directly across the English Channel. Since that June day when our men first landed upon the Normandy beaches, one of the notable campaigns of all time has been carried out. Working in effective cooperation with the Great Red Army and the Allied forces in Italy, the French, British, American, and other Allied forces in this theater have battled their way with ever-increasing speed and power through the most formidable defenses that Germany could devise. The soldier, the sailor, and the airman, supported by the devoted efforts of thousands laboring in the services of supply, and aided by numerous comrades in the resistance movements, first won the Battle of the Beaches. They won the pursuit across France, the campaign to destroy the Germans west of the Rhine, and the crossings of that historical obstacle. Then they pierced the heart of Germany to join up there with their Russian and Allied comrades coming from the east and from the south. This has been no separate war of air, of ground, and of sea. All have been welded together into one engine of avenging power to the dismay and destruction of our enemies. These startling successes have not been bought without sorrow and suffering. In this theater alone, 80,000 Americans, in comparable numbers among their allies, have had their lives cut short that the rest of us might live in the sunlight of freedom. 400,000 of our citizens have borne the pain of physical wounds, and additional thousands have suffered privation in Nazi prison camps. The American men and women of this theater, constituting the mightiest military force the United States has ever committed to action, solemnly salute our own honored dead and extend to every relative, to every friend of all these, our deepest sentiments of respect and sympathy. But at last, this part of the job is done. No more will there flow from this theater to the United States those doleful lists of death and loss that have brought so much sorrow to American homes. The sounds of battle have faded from the European scene. Permit me now a more personal word. It has been my great honor and equal responsibility to command Allied forces in the Mediterranean and later, the Allied Expeditionary Force in Europe. This gives me the right to voice my lasting appreciation to numbers of people that have, by their consideration, their understanding, and their efficiency, made my task a bearable one. To my own superiors in the British-American Combined Chiefs of Staff and the political heads of our two countries, I address my profound thanks. We here fully realize the immeasurable debt we owe to their wisdom, their forbearance, and their staunch support. We trust that all our peoples have the same realization. Merely to name my own present and former principal subordinates in this theater is to present a picture of the utmost in loyalty, skill, selflessness, and efficiency. The United Nations will gratefully remember Tedder, Bradley, Montgomery, Ramsey, Spots, DeLatt, and countless others. But all these agree with me in the selection of the truly heroic man of this war. He is G.I. Joe, and his counterpart in the air, the Navy, and the merchant marine of every one of the United Nations. He has surmounted the dangers of U-boat infested seas, of bitter battles in the air, of desperate charges into defended beaches, of tedious, dangerous fighting against the ultimate in fortified zones. He has uncomplainingly endured cold, mud, fatigue. His companion has been danger, and death has trailed his footsteps. He and his platoon and company leaders have given to us a record of gallantry, loyalty, devotion to duty, and patient endurance that will warm our hearts for as long as those qualities excite our admiration. So, history's mightiest machine of conquest has been utterly destroyed. The deliberate design of brutal, worldwide rape that the German nation, eagerly absorbed from the diseased brain of Hitler, has met the fate decreed for it by outraged justice. The self-styled super race that 6 years ago set out on a career of pillage is now groveling amongst the ruins of its own shattered cities as it fearfully hopes for a better fate than it inflicted upon its own helpless victims. Throughout the United Nations, the rejoicing bells peal forth. Those bells voice our happiness that the Nazi scourge has been eliminated from the earth. But for the remaining enemy of humankind, Japan, those bells are sounding an imminent doom. The complete armed might of liberty and freedom is at last free to turn from the elimination of the principal criminal to the punishment of its equally despicable satellite. Already our comrades in the Pacific have made great inroads into her vitals. Japan herself must now realize her fate is sealed. All of us here have one underlying ambition, to return speedily to our families. But we entered this war to do our duty to our country and to the cause that remains as sacred today as on that December 7th when we suddenly found ourselves at war. Wherever any man is called, he will continue to do his part in assuring the completeness of victory. Some of us will stay here to police the areas and the nation that we have conquered, so that systems of justice and of order may prevail. Some will be called upon to participate in the Pacific War. But some, and I trust in ever-increasing numbers, will soon experience the joy of returning home. I speak for the more than 3 million Americans in this theater in saying that, when we are so fortunate as to come back to you, there need be no welcoming parades, no special celebrations. All we ask is to come back into the warmth of the hearts we left behind and to resume once more pursuits of peace under our own American conceptions of liberty and of right in which our beloved country has always dwelt.
From Headquarters, Supreme Commander, Allied Expeditionary Force, where General of the Army Eisenhower has just spoken, we return to the United States.
Washington, the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Fleet and Chief of Naval Operations, Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King, is ready to address the nation and the men under his command ashore and afloat throughout the seven seas.
Admiral King, we congratulate the United States Army and the armed forces of our allies
for effecting the actual entry into Germany and destroying her ability to make war. We congratulate the Air Forces for their victory over the Luftwaffe and for their support of those engaged in fighting on the ground. Though there were few naval surface actions in the Atlantic in the traditional sense, the Navy's contribution to the European victory was substantial. The winning of the Battle of the Atlantic against the U-boats was a requisite to the winning of the Battle of Europe. The Allied navies landed our ground forces on the soil of Normandy, and despite the enemy's U-boat campaigns, maintained the flow of supplies. The Navy further assisted Allied ground forces in the climactic crossing of the Rhine barrier. This operation, as all others, required the closest cooperation between the United States Army and Navy. While we now congratulate those who have achieved victory in Europe, we must not forget those thousands who gave their lives fighting to make this victory possible. They died that we might have the privilege of continuing to enjoy American liberty as we have known it. Our sympathy and our humble appreciation go out to their bereaved families and friends. During the past year, the war in the Pacific has progressed at an accelerated tempo. In that area, we are still securing positions from which to launch heavier and more concentrated offenses against the Japanese homeland. At the same time, the closer we get to the heart of Japan, the stronger we find her resistance. As we have experienced on Saipan and on Iwo Jima, and more recently, on Okinawa. The farther we advance, the longer our vital supply lines become, further complicating our already complex logistics system. The problem of convoying the million of troops now in Europe, halfway around the world to the Far East, is one of the most immense which any naval force ever faced. To supply them, once they get there, will be almost equally difficult. These problems must be, and are being, solved even as we continue to press home the campaigns now underway in the far Pacific. Coordination of effort among the fighting forces and the efforts of workers on the home front have made possible our success so far and will continue to be essential to ultimate victory. We sincerely wish that this could have been a day of victory on all fronts, but we know that the tough kernel of Japanese resistance remains to be crushed. Hence, we must pursue the war in the Pacific with increased determination and with a maximum of equipment and trained personnel. Therefore, let us make this not a day of celebration primarily or only, but rather a day of rededication to the task that yet remains ahead of us, total and rapid defeat of the Japanese enemy.
That was the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Fleet and Chief of Naval Operations, Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King. We take you now to Pacific Fleet Headquarters on Guam to hear Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief, United States Pacific Fleet and Pacific Ocean Area. Admiral Nimitz.
Throughout the Pacific Fleet and all the fighting forces in the Pacific Ocean areas, there is jubilation and thanksgiving. This is a day for which the world's people who understand freedom and justice have long prayed. The forces of tyranny and aggression in Europe are crushed. The way is open now for the resumption of the onward march of progress and civilization. The victory of the Allied forces is the work of many hands and many minds. It is a victory for our armed forces, but also a victory for the industries that arm them. It is a victory won by united effort at home and in the zones of combat. This is particularly a day of glory for General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander, and for the leaders of our gallant army. Generals Marshall, Arnold, McNair, Stilwell, Somerville, Bradley, Cuff, Hodges, Simpson, Hotman, Fox, and others have earned the admiration and gratitude of this and future generations. Today, they also honor our staunch allies, the British Commonwealth of Nations, which never falters, never sinks, in spite of setbacks and her outlook when she steadily on. Russia, which was nearly overrun by Hitler's legions in 1942, had staged a magnificent rally unmatched in military history to eject the attackers from Moscow. And our other allies, who, with more limited military resources, nevertheless, extended to us unlimited cooperation. Above all, today we honor the valiant men of the United Nations who gave their lives in defense of their homes and all things enlightened people hold good. The record of their victory and the memory of their valor will never die. Now we can turn the full force of our fighting capacity against Japan. In this fact, the thousands of American men fighting in the Pacific can find a cause for encouragement, but little cause for celebration. The job calls for too much hard fighting and too much hard work to afford it. We do not count on a quick end to our war with Japan. If the enemy's actions were at all times dictated by common sense, he might choose to surrender soon. He is already cut off from most of his necessary raw materials. The war industries of Japan have taken severe pounding. There is nothing in prospect for them but a continually mounting pressure apparent on Allied land, sea, and air power with eventual complete destruction. But we expect it will be necessary to apply much more pressure against their tough and tenacious foe. The faster we can build it up, the sooner will come the day of Japan's defeat. In the task ahead, we shall in due course have the powerful help of great armies and air forces from the European theater. We have gained a sufficient control of the sea and air to ensure these forces an unlimited source of objective. If all we have gained, all we have built, all we have planned to achieve, victory in the Pacific, will be of no avail without one element. That indispensable element is the continued support and sustaining faith of all the American people until the complete defeat is declared.
You have just heard Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz speaking from Pacific Fleet Headquarters on Guam. We return you to the United States.
Won in the air as well as on the land and on the sea. And the Empire of Japan can expect the full weight of American air power now released from European skies. For an account of American air power, the combined American networks bring you General of the Army, H.H. Arnold, Commanding General, Army Air Forces. General Arnold.
This is a day of rejoicing. A battle. A bitter and bloody battle has been won. The men who won it, your sons, brothers, husbands, have triumphed over a host of relentless, desperate, and powerful enemies. They have earned the deepest, most enduring gratitude of every civilized human being in whatever country for all time to come. They have indeed given the world a day for rejoicing. The United States Army Air Forces is proud of what it has done toward making this day possible. To provide the air power needed for victory over the Axis partners in Europe, the Army Air Forces has had to travel a long way over an arduous road. Simultaneously, it had to initiate and supervise the production of more than 150,000 airplanes, train 2.5 million men, and fight on a dozen potentially decisive fronts. When the first day of the war was over, on the night of December 7, 1941, the Army Air Forces found itself with less than 200 airplanes deployed against our enemies. Today's airplanes were either just beginning to roll off the production lines or just entering the blueprint stage. Our airmen were still in pre-flight training, behind office or school desks, raw young civilians for the most part. Remember, too, if you will, the German Air Force in the early days of this war. When the German armies rolled through Poland, Norway, and France, they were spearheaded, covered, and backed up by the pride of Nazi militarism, the Luftwaffe. We knew that before our own armies could come back, before they could mount a successful invasion of the European continent, this German Air Force would have to be shattered. The German Air Force was shattered. Our fighters, bombers, ruined it in the air. And our strategic bombardment ruined the source of its strength on the ground. Together with the Royal Air Force, we disrupted the entire German war economy. We forced them on the defensive and gave an airtight cover to our invasion on D-Day. When the time came, we paralyzed our transportation system to the point where the German ground forces were unable to execute the most desperately needed maneuvers. Air power was our margin of victory. And the thing to remember on this of all days is that to give us this all-important margin, tens of thousands of the finest young men who ever lived lie in nameless graves scattered everywhere. For many months now, scarcely a day has passed without our B-29s making their appearance over the Japanese homeland. The men in those airplanes know what their job is. Japanese industry will have to be battered into the same chaos that engulfed Germany's war machine. That is a campaign barely begun. Daily, our air crews return to their work at the risk of death and of capture by the Japanese. They have read the details of the death march on Bataan as closely as you have. They know what and whom they're up against. And yet they return to their targets day after day, night after night, simply because they know that it must be done. Remember those men on this day. Remember that although a great battle has been won, their war, your war, goes on.
American will ever forget Bataan and Corregidor. To hear from the man who led our forces back to Corregidor, the combined American networks take you to the Philippines for an address by General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur, Commander-in-Chief, United States Army Forces in the Pacific. General MacArthur.
My fellow Americans, I rejoice with you in the triumph of Allied arms, which has restored human liberty to the enslaved peoples of Europe. Rejoice that this phase of the titanic struggle in which our country has long been engaged has now been brought to a victorious conclusion. And rejoice that this command, presently engaging our remaining enemy on many fronts, will now be reinforced by that vast and powerful resource of war heretofore employed on the battlefields of Europe. Through this additional strength, the Japanese Empire will be the more speedily vanquished with greater economy of American and Allied life than otherwise would be possible. We rejoice over these things, and in deep gratitude, pay tribute to the gallant fighting men and service women who, with our allies, have made them possible. In the historic pattern of our race, they, who in their hearts abhorred war, have, by necessity, risen to magnificent and masterful height in the prosecution of war. And toward our enemies, for generations have practiced and sought to live by war, an irrefutable lesson in its utter futility as an instrument of national progress. At the same time, we pay tribute to those other great forces constituting our national strength, which are equally essential to the attainment of victory. I refer to those who by their toil and technical skill have forged the weapons without which the stoutest heart and strongest arm is lost in the crucible of modern war. And to the mothers, wives, and other loved ones of our fighting men, who by their courage and fortitude and patience have steeled the soldier heart to an unyielding will for victory. In war, the balance of power being otherwise equal, the spiritual strength of his home dominates the soldier at the front and oft-times controls the very tide of battle itself. In this spiritual strength, those brave and noble American mothers, of whom I speak in all humility and admiration, have never been found wanting. Them, the unsung heroines of war, is due more than to all others, the accolade of victory. Yet, while we rejoice over the great successes which now permit us to gird our full national strength the better to meet the tests of battle in the East, it is well that we pause to reflect in realistic appreciation of the effects of war upon the victorious as well as upon the vanquished. War's course, regardless of motive or result, is heavy. The lessons of its destructive effect are no less compelling upon us in victory than upon our enemies in defeat. The survival and progress of humanity under the burdens this war has imposed is only possible if thereby the consciousness of mankind is aroused to the realization that war is inimical to human progress and a more constructive means is sought and found to preserve order and settle disputes among the peoples of the earth. Trend of current thought offers proof that this will be done. And as the representatives of the Allied nations now convene in search for the way, it is incumbent upon all to give them their full support and pray for divine guidance of their deliberations in the achievement of this lofty purpose. The members of this command salute their comrades in arms, victors of the war in the West, as we rededicate ourselves to the task which yet lies ahead in the East. However monumental such task, with the help of Almighty God, we shall not fail. From General MacArthur's headquarters in the Philippines, we return you to the United States.
Chief of Naval Chaplains, Rear Admiral Robert D. Workman, with a prayer and a benediction for victory in the Pacific.
Eternal Father, author of all wisdom and understanding, we come to thee in deep humility and reverent thanksgiving for thy great and unspeakable mercies to us this day. Especially bless, we pray, all those whom thou hast called to direct our continuing efforts. Grant them strength and integrity of purpose as they strive to lead us in the task that remains as yet unfinished. Guide us that our efforts may be pleasing in thy sight. Grant that we may keep our minds and hearts unscarred by the cruelties of our time. Unite us, O God, in true love of mankind, that we may deserve the benefits of a just peace. Help us to overcome selfishness and greed, and fill our hearts with steadfastness of purpose as we continue to strive for the promise of that blessed day when all nations and all peoples shall come to know and to cherish a world at peace. Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, our national anthem. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to an historic broadcast. You have heard from the top-ranking officers of the United States Army and Navy on this special program, memorializing victory in Europe, with the five-star admirals and generals of our armed forces speaking to you from their headquarters around the world. You have heard Fleet Admiral William D. Lay, General of the Army George C. Marshall, Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King, General of the Army Dwight D. Eisenhower, Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, General of the Army H.H. Arnold, and General of the Army Douglas MacArthur. We are proud and honored to have presented this broadcast on this day of days. In just 2 minutes, you will hear John B. Kennedy and his up-to-the-minute comment on the news of the day. John B. Kennedy will be heard over most of these stations.
This is the Blue Network of the American Broadcasting Company.